Hello and welcome to Colonial Outcast, your friendly neighborhood podcast about empire and imperialism and stuff. My name is Greg Stoker. I'm joined by co-host Mark Wayne. And I'm basically just here to do the intro on this episode because we're going to touch on military indoctrination. And though I've been out of the military for years, there's this massive festival where I live. It's called South by Southwest, and we are currently boycotting it because it's sponsored this year by both the U.S. Army and Raytheon. So I've been going to a lot of anti-South by Southwest punk and metal shows in town, and I was supposed to go to bed early last night because we're recording this podcast in the morning, but one of my friends was like, "Hey, you're going home and going to bed? I thought you were an Army Ranger." And of course, that challenge to my credibility led me to staying out till like 4 a.m. and being an idiot. And now I feel like death. And I'm sure this all sounds dumb. Yes, guys are dumb. And I am incidentally a guy. But the point I'm trying to make is that this old, stupid indoctrination is very powerful. And it can manifest, obviously, in much darker ways. We are actively witnessing a genocide in Palestine in real time. And as a former soldier, I struggle to comprehend the behavior of the IOF soldiers on the ground in Gaza. It's absolutely inhumane and unconscionable. I've been trying to understand it, which is intellectually and emotionally challenging. So I'm very grateful that we have Yuval coming on the show. He was a former soldier in Israel, because growing up in Israel, service in the military is and was compulsory. So he's here to talk about his experiences and his perspective. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I first discovered you through your social media account. You were doing a kind of like a walk and talk video about your experiences in the Israeli military. And I think I'm just going to play a clip from one of your Instagram videos, and we'll just jump right in. I think it's like 2 minutes. If that's all right. Hang on. Trying to work the technology. Here we go. All right.
We are all witnessing with horror and heartbreak the results of Israeli leadership, Israeli citizens, and Israeli soldiers who have been dehumanizing Palestinians for more than 75 years. And we are asking ourselves, how the hell can this be? How can human beings behave in this way? And as someone who has served in the Israeli occupation forces and grew up in Israel, I can tell you that it takes a lot of dehumanizing yourself and being dehumanized by the powers that be to reduce yourself to such a level that you are able to enact or stand behind such unbelievable atrocities. Because this goes beyond just, oh, Israelis don't know what's going on. They know what's going on. Maybe they are not exposed to the same level of atrocities that we all are. Maybe a lot of it is being hidden from them deliberately, for sure. But at the same time, we all have access to the internet. They've been living there and seeing the walls, seeing the apartheid happening, and still resisting and refusing to acknowledge this is going on. There is something deeper going on, and I think it has to do with this dehumanization of self. When I was in the IOF, it was one of the worst periods of my life. I was so depressed. And of course, part of it was just being part of something that I resisted from the beginning, just because I had to, because I was forced to, because I didn't know as an 18-year-old that I have the choice to refuse and that going to jail for refusing will be okay and definitely worth it. I just didn't know. I was afraid. But beyond that, I think it was this fact that I felt that I was reduced to nothing but a number. I was nobody. I was nobody. And if I had something to say, I would be immediately humiliated and punished for it. I was just nobody. And when you're nobody, when you're nothing but a number, your actions don't matter as much. Or at least that's the feeling that you are getting.
Well, thanks, Yuval, for like putting that out there and sharing that message.
Really appreciate your videos.
By the way, just checking in because you were breaking out just a little bit, and also the video. So you guys are hearing and seeing me well?
Yeah. So he has an internet delay, and it's but it's recording locally. Okay. So after this finishes, his computer will upload the video, and it'll look crisp when it comes out.
So. Yeah. We're just gonna have to deal with technical issues. It's totally my internet's fault. It's not yours.
No worries. It's Austin. It's just all of Austin. Everywhere he goes in Austin, it's apparently bad.
Yeah.
All right.
So Yuval, can you tell us just a little brief background on who you are? I'm sure a lot of people already know, but for those who haven't been exposed to you, can you just give us the layout of the land, where you were born, everything?
Sure. First of all, I think it's a bit funny because like you found the pretty much the worst IDF soldier that has ever existed. I hated every minute there, and I was such a bad soldier. I was like trying to do my philosophy throughout the whole 3 years was doing the minimum necessary at any given moment. So yeah, but
that was my philosophy too in the army. That's a crazy coincidence.
Anyway, I was born in Jerusalem. I'm from a family of both people who came from Germany in the 1800s, Holocaust survivors from Poland, and also people from Syria, Morocco, and even Palestinians who lived in Palestine for thousands of years. So a very mixed kind of background. And I grew up in a similarly mixed family of like leftists, liberals, hardcore settlers, like any aspect of Israeli society is in my family and in my vicinity. I grew up in Jewish Orthodox community, in like the Haredim community, which is supposedly anti-Zionist, or at least when I was there, the anti-Zionism was like a big part of education. But over the last, I guess, decades, I think there has been a trend of that community deteriorating and being corrupted into, you know, Zionism. And I think part of it is proximity to power, and suddenly they have more and more influence in the electoral, from an electoral point of view, and like parliament members and so on. And you know, they say in Israel, the occupation corrupts, and I think that's part of it. But generally speaking, my education was not particularly super Zionist. My first formative years, I was actually not born into a very Orthodox family. I was born to a pretty hippie, into psychedelics and, you know, Indian gurus kind of parents. And they sent me to like Waldorf Democratic School. And we were like kind of like Tel Avivian liberal type Israelis.
I would have never guessed by looking at you.
Yeah. No, I had everything. I had like the hat and the zingalach and everything, like super Hasidic, you know. And then when I was 10, we kind of flipped, and I was moved from like democratic school, the most liberal school you can imagine, to like boys only cheder. And I spent most of my formative years there until I was like 17. So my exposure to Zionist propaganda and Zionist kind of brainwash was more through like, proximity to family and settlers that I grew up around, rather than like education system per se. For example, in 2005, when they evacuated the Gaza Strip or the Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip, I was there physically because I had like family members who lived there in the settlements. Mm-hmm. So I was like one of the people who, you know, were there until they literally grab us and put us in buses and driven us out.
That was a disengagement, they called
it. Exactly, yeah.
I was there. That's when I arrived, was in 2005 when that was going on. And I was confused about what was happening. Can you, like, I know now what was happening at the time with Ariel Sharon pulling the settlers out and everybody was making a big fuss about it. Can you go into more detail just a little bit about what the background was on the disengagement?
Yeah, so basically it was a one-sided decision that Sharon made. I think, like, I'm not a geopolitical expert, but from what I gathered, it was a very strategic kind of move to remove even the last shred of kind of claim that Palestinians in Gaza have
or rather the only thing that would prevent him from having a full siege of Gaza, which is having Jewish settlements within the Gaza Strip. And I think also some other, you know, things that he took into account, like the insane military budget that he took to keep these settlements within the Gaza Strip that was under Hamas's control. So a lot of resistance, a lot of attack, a lot of shootings, a lot of bombs. You know, like my the settlers, like some of the children, would drive to school in a fully kind of like bulletproof trucks made out of cement, just to kind of avoid the danger. So you can imagine how, you know, the military budget for that. Anyway, they decided to one-sidedly just disengage. It was a very unpopular move, both by the left and the right and everybody in between within Israeli society. I think that the kind of like right-leaning settler movement was really against it because, you know, the vision of the complete Israel, and it all belongs to us. And on the other hand, you had the liberals and leftists that were like, this is a one-sided solution. It's not a really sustainable peace agreement or anything that really helps. So basically, it's just suffering for everybody.
Yeah, I remember that was the buzz of the town. A lot of Israelis were talking about that. And I'm curious was, where did the left stand on that whole situation?
I think very similarly, mostly against that because of its one-sidedness. It didn't come from like an actual political solution of negotiating a peace agreement or anything. It was just like, you know, a strategic solution that only served to further the already very skewed kind of political aims of the right.
Right. And this was it. So 2005, this was happening. How old were you at the time?
I mean, I'm 33 now.
So yeah, like I was
15, I guess. 14,
15.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So work from that point on to when you got conscripted into the IDF.
So when I was like 18, I went to the IDF. I was back then, I already left a year before like the yeshiva. Basically, if you're from the Orthodox community, you don't go to the army. They don't. Actually, they are trying to cancel this law right now because obviously they don't have enough soldiers. And they are protesting and all that. But basically, I left that community. I went to a more liberal but still very religious kind of institution in which they do go to the army, but just for like a year and a half. This is like settlers. Mm-hmm. It's like Zionists, Jewish, Orthodox settlers, basically. Mm-hmm. In Safed, funny enough, this is where my ancestors are from. And when I finished with that, I was like, no, I actually, because you go for a year and a half and then you have to go back to the yeshiva. And I didn't want to go back to this place. I was like leaving religion. And I was like, okay, I'm done with it. So I went for 3 years. Unfortunately, I was already self-proclaimed a pacifist. I already was kind of like awakening to the realities of occupation. Definitely not to the level that I am right now. I was still under the kind of illusion, as most liberal Israelis are, that, yeah, it's true, the occupation is bad, but we still need to kind of keep ourselves safe because these people want to kill us. So I'm basically keeping my family safe, right?
Yeah.
That was kind of like when I started.
No, that's really an interesting point that I don't think a lot of outsiders understand, like the liberal Israeli viewpoint of, you know, we acknowledge that occupation is bad, but it's necessary. And that's the liberal viewpoint. And I actually watch a lot of military channels and they have IDF soldiers come on and interview these guys. And, you know, they kind of seem liberal, but they're, you know, they just got back from like fighting in Gaza and they're saying these talking points. It's like on October 7th, basically Hamas hit the kibbutzes and they all say, like, the kibbutzes, they're very liberal. Like, they're the ones who are, like, reaching out saying, like, we want peace with the Palestinians. And then, like, Hamas hit them. And
unprovoked.
From my perspective, unprovoked. Yeah, unprovoked. And, you know, there's this idea that, you know, that there's this push for peace and for coexistence. But it's kind of like, dude, you're still on essentially stolen land. And, you know, you could say this all you want, that, yeah, you want to come to an accord with the Palestinians, but it's just words. And yeah. So this liberal Israeli view is actually very interesting to me because of the dissonance. Yeah,
and it's very similar to liberals all around, but there is a special kind of Israeli flavor. They would not even call themselves liberal. They would say we are leftists. So this is like the Israeli left. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about like some of my friends that, you know, I have friends who wrote letters to refusing to go to reserves to the, you know, to some high profile generals and saying that they are doing it because of conscientiousness. And then protested, like we had conversations, long conversations for years about the occupation and the illegality of settlements and all that stuff. They are very aware to what's going on. They are as far as you can imagine, almost from staunch Zionists. As 7th of October hit, and I was having the same conversations with them, some of them were talking about going and volunteering to the army to go fight in Gaza. And suddenly the whole conversation changed flavor completely. And they are all like, oh, anti-Zionism is the worst thing that is happening, right? Anti-Semitism is the worst thing that happening right now. It's in rise everywhere. We are going to be annihilated. Hamas is like a Nazi anti-Semitic organization. And it's like really like parroting everything that I've been, you know, hearing. And it was so bizarre to me to have these conversations with them. And this is, by the way, even before October 7th, when Netanyahu was trying to kind of like maneuver the power away from the Supreme Court, the only judicial body that has any power over the Israeli government, in order to basically become a dictator. And everybody would go and protest. Like millions of Israeli liberals, including my friends, were talking about saving democracy. And I remember having these conversations with them way before October 7th. And I was like, what fucking democracy? Like I would look at some videos and I saw like people that bring a Palestinian flag to these protests were beaten. That's before October 7th, right? So there was not like even then, even suggesting that if you really want a true democracy, you have to fight shoulder to shoulder with the Palestinians living in Israel and all around Israel was like the most insane thing that you can do. So you can imagine how that escalated after October 7th.
That was my experience with an Israeli friend of mine. He was very close in Los Angeles. He was actually a co-producer for a movie we were working on. And he was a very liberal guy. He was a very open-minded, spiritual guy, kind of like yourself, maybe not as much, but he was a little orthodox and he seemed very enlightened. And I remember after October 7th, the first person I called was him. And I said, first thing I asked him was, hey, does this make sense to you? What's going on? And he's like, does any of it make sense? He's like, no, it doesn't. And so we automatically were thinking along the same lines. Now, a week later, I noticed he just shifted where he was. I was talking like, yo, man, like they're talking about like bombing Gaza.
Yep.
Like, this is fucking bad, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, this is fucking terrible. They're gonna kill children. And he's just like, yeah, well, they got to do what they got to do. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you, dude? Yeah. What happened to you?
Exactly.
And I said, I was just, he switched. And I was like, I said, look, bro, this is going to take you down a dark path. Like this whole October 7th thing, make sure it doesn't lead you down this path of hate where all of a sudden you're just going full on, you know, sociopathic Nazi on me, dude. And that was that conversation was a breaking point. And I'm like, look, these are kids. We have to understand like what Israel's about to do is really fucking wrong. And he's just, and that conversation was the last talk I had with him,
yeah.
a good friend of mine. And I'm just like, what the hell's happening? So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, imagine all of this happening with almost the entirety of my family, everybody but my little brother, who is fucking great, and almost 100% of my Israeli friends. And again, people who used to speak about occupation corrupts and even you know, go to protest, like go help Palestinians in the West Bank, like things like that. And suddenly are like, oh yeah, I think the best thing is like we get all the Palestinians out, we kill all of Hamas, we bring them back. Or like, I don't care what happens to them. They can all go to the ocean as far as I'm concerned. Like super
exactly.
stuff. And I'm like,
exactly.
What the fuck, you know?
And you think that you're going crazy because of it, you know, but you just realize that this is must have been what it felt like at different points in history where society just went fucking nuts and started killing people like the Nazis or any other pogrom that happened. You ask yourself, how do people even go to do that? You can't really visualize it until it's happening around you like it is right now.
Yep.
Reasonable people that you thought were reasonable, but now they're just completely, you know, well, took some stupid pills.
Yeah. Well, also like ideologically they were primed for it. Like we saw this.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a lot of stuff reflected in the Israeli narrative that was reflected in the post 9/11 American narrative, you know, this idea that, you know, they're all going to be terrorists one day. It takes a village. Heard that on the ground in combat. It's like, oh, sorry. You know, we smoked someone who shouldn't have been smoked, but you know what? It's all right. It takes a village, you know? So I'm seeing a lot of parallels there. Obviously it's way more hardcore in Israel than it ever was in the US military. But
I think the part of it that makes it more hardcore is that Americans for the most part have never felt a generational, visceral, traumatic, real fear of their own annihilation. And Jewish people did, and it's valid and true. You know, that experience in and of itself is something that you cannot completely ignore out of this equation. It's real, it exists. Most of these people, like my friends who are talking in this way, as much as I completely disagree with them, I don't sympathize with them, but I can empathize with them. I can understand where they are coming from. I can see the pain. I can see the fear. And as someone who comes from a family of Holocaust survivors, I know the fear. You know, I'm looking at my own grandpa, who, unlike some Holocaust survivors in the diaspora that see what's going on and see the parallels between Nazi Germany and able to look at it in, you know, a critical way. For him, it's impossible. He came to Israel after, you know, his entire family being annihilated in the Holocaust. After a few years after the war, being brainwashed by youth Zionist organizations, recruiting people in Europe, they came to Israel. He convinced his mom to go to Israel after Germany instead of going to America as she wanted to. And then, as he's there, like he's coming, like 15, 16, a carabiner in his hand, go fight all the wars, right? And he's like a child fighting all of these wars. And now is of course, also years of watching TV and looking at what's going on and blah, blah, blah. And he would tell you, like, it's all Netanyahu's problem. Like, he's not like a far right by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. But at the same time, like, it's almost impossible to detach this trauma and this pain from these people, and it's something that we really need to help them do, you know.
And well, can you go into more about that, about how that works, how that whole mechanism of inducing fear and paranoia into the population, spreading this idea that all the Palestinians want to annihilate the Jews? I experienced that from an American perspective over there, going to like this one Kabbalah center I went to, with some American Jews, and I heard this sermon given by this Kabbalah, you know, rabbi, and he was using one of the verses in the Torah. I think it was the one between Esau and Yaakov, and how Yaakov wanted to annihilate him for stealing the blessing, and somehow he engineered, and as you know, the end of that storyline between Esau and Yaakov was actually very positive. Yaakov hugged him, but there's a Kabbalistic translation of that that goes completely opposite. And I saw this rabbi using that passage to give the ultimate lesson of you cannot trust the goy, even the ones that seem nice to you. They want to annihilate you. And then now us Americans, including the American Jews, were kind of like, this is fucking nuts. This is dark. Like, this is not how we were raised. This is not how American Jews are raised. At least that was their perspective, those American Jews I was with. And we left there kind of with a really bad taste in our mouth. And it was kind of a wake-up call to Israeli society that, like, wow, this is really unhealthy to think like this. No wonder they're so scared and paranoid and so trigger-happy against the Palestinians. It's an indoctrination from the ground up. And now, on this, that was the American perspective. The Israeli perspective is, do you see that type of thing in high schools, in elementary schools, in most, what would you say the percentages are? Like, how widespread is it in that society?
Oh, absolutely. It's everywhere. You know, they never tell you, like, kill Arabs, you know? And this is, like, how most Israelis will argue that Israel is not a inherently genocidal, dehumanizing society, because they say, nobody ever told us that we should kill Arabs. But it's happening in very subtle, very persistent ways. One of which you witnessed an anecdote of taking Jewish symbolism, history, you know, ideas, philosophy, and co-opting them while obviously completely ignoring the depth of the actual tradition, completely co-opting them into this conquest, nationalistic kind of
and supremacy river. Supremacy Jewish exactly. Supremacy was a problem. Now
exactly,
most of the American Jews I know have absolutely no Jewish supremacy bone in their body, but when we went to Israel as when they were, you know, being amongst American Jewish students, and we would be exposed to, like, the Israeli religious schools, yeshivas, I went to a few yeshivas, you know. And I saw this supremacist ideology, and for me, it was like, this goes in antithesis to Judaism. What are we doing here? Like, this makes no sense. It was kind of like, I wasn't perceptive of that prior to going to Israel.
Yeah.
But after going to Israel, I suddenly realized what the problem was. And it's not Judaism. It's this engineering of Judaism to weaponize it, just like Christianity was done in the past, you know, blaming the Jews for the death of Jesus. Therefore, we have to, you know, conquer Jerusalem and, you know, get rid of the Jews, get rid of the enemies of Jesus. It's the same type of thing. It's just branded as Judaism.
Exactly.
But it all goes back to this white supremacy.
Yeah.
You know, so like, at what point did you realize, like, how you that you needed to go polar opposite to that ideology?
I mean,
you had like a subtle, you obviously, you mentioned that you were still a little bit indoctrinated and still had that residual brainwashing effects lasting in your brain. But what point did you say, no, I got to go completely polar opposite of what this is?
I don't think there was one point. I think it was a gradual process of, you know, seeing, first of all, growing up next to some really extreme settlers, you know, the people who... you see in documentaries, or like going to a random hill in the West Bank and conquering it and literally building a house there, that kind of vibe, or planning and talking about, like, you know, retaliation, you know, actions in Palestinian villages at night and stuff like that. I think I spoke about it in one of my videos. I remember when I was like, even before 2005 and this engagement with Gaza, I think it was like maybe 11 or 12 or 13 or something like that. I was walking. I practically grew up in the old city of Jerusalem. My grandparents lived there, just 2 minutes walk from like Al-Aqsa and the West Wall. And I was walking next to my cousin, who is from a family of like, you know, pretty staunch Zionist settlers. And we were walking around in the Muslim quarter when suddenly he sprints towards a Palestinian child, kicks him in the balls as hard as he could with his boots, and then runs and disappears into one of the kind of alleys and leaves me there. And I was like so shocked. I just couldn't fathom, why would someone do that? And, you know, that was kind of like a point that I remember vividly, like seeing the dehumanization and the kind of, I wasn't grown up enough or developed enough to really contemplate that and reflect on that well, but I think it did something really inside of me. At least to the point that when I was going into the army, I was already against the existence of an army in general. And then later, being in the army, going to the West Bank for a while, being in the checkpoints, seeing buses of Palestinians in all ages from all walks of life, being humiliated every single fucking day at 3, 4 a.m., being searched the food bags by dirty hands of you know, IDF soldiers, sometimes being tied up, eyes shut and hands behind back and just beaten, or, you know, 70-year-old Palestinian just in the sun for hours for absolutely no reason. And also hearing the kind of rhetoric around me of how excited and exhilarated some of them were at any opportunity to terrorize Palestinian lives. They were like begging the higher command to give them any kind of you know, instructions or like activities in the villages or something to do that terrorizes Palestinian lives, like really deep hate. And of course, there were also some people around me that felt very similarly to me, and I imagine maybe are in similar place today, I don't know. But that was kind of like the majority of the people around you. And then finishing the army, starting to travel the world, leaving Israel, starting to have actual Palestinian friends that I don't see through the, you know, my rifle or through the checkpoint or without, you know, just as a soldier. And actually having friends and having conversations with them, which at first were very triggering and slowly, you know, became more humbling and educating. And I think that was like a gradual, slow and gradual process of really like completely waking up from the wasteland of Zionist indoctrination.
Yeah. And you know, what's something that's confounding to me is people who grow up in like the UK or Canada or the United States, and they leave their country of origin to go and serve in the IDF, because as dual citizens, it's I don't think it's compulsory. Like if you're an American citizen, like you do not have to serve in the IDF. So like going over to do like 2 or 3 years or to just come over since October 7th and to, you know, quote unquote, fight in Gaza for 2 months, then go back home to your job and your family, like nothing ever happened. Like that's actually completely confounding to me. And I struggle to understand it. So
I can explain it to you from what compelled me to want to do it back at 18 years old. All was right. That it was this idea. Here's what it is. It's this idea that you are fighting in the biblical Israelite army. So it's this idea that you have an identity. But it's also, it's not just that though. It's also the fact that you want to feel a sense of belonging to somebody on another side of the planet that you're equal to other people. And so it's that sense of wanting to belong and have an identity, have something to be proud of. And I, you know, they have a special unit for Christians. For non-Jewish Christians, American Christians in the IDF. So I wanted to join that.
So much for being equals.
Yeah, exactly. But I wanted to join that and I was about to, but one of my Palestinian friends said, Mark, don't do it. And I'm just like, well, why not, man? Like, I feel like I could be a good influence there. Like, I'm not going to, maybe I can help influence the IDF to and all the other soldiers to have compassion on Palestinians and to love them again. He's like, Mark.
Yeah, totally, Mark, man.
What they're going to do,
you're going to change
they're
everything.
They're going to put you in a compromise. Yeah. That's what I was like, bro, like, dude, man, I'm going to spread like the love of Jesus amongst them. But he told me, he's like, Mark, do not do that. They will make you into a murderer. They're going to put you in a compromising situation. And then at that point, you're going to have to make a decision and you're going to be pressured into making the wrong decision. And at that point, we've lost a friend. We've lost a human being. And it was that conversation that I was like, Yeah, you know, it's a lot of paperwork anyways. I'll pass on it.
Yeah, I mean, this is very illuminating because I've never been in a position of someone from outside of Israel deciding on their own accord. Like, even as an IDF soldier, when I was there, if I had the chance to not do it, I would take it any moment. Like, I tried to do everything in my power to not, you know, to not be involved as much as I can. I try to plead to go to become like, it's called a jobnik, which is people who are not like combat. I tried like so many different things, you know, and yeah, I just wanted to do the least as possible. So it's illuminating to see someone who is from the other side of like being indoctrinated into feeling this like pride of being going there, because I've never had pride. That thing is for sure. I've never had pride. And I remember always looking around and being, even without the awareness and consciousness that I have today about Zionism and all like the ability to see it, connect the dots backward and look at it from the outside, even then I just looked around as an 18, 19 year old and just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I remember being on the Lebanese border in like, or Syrian border, and like in the Syrian border sometimes, it's like in the triangle of like Jordan, Syria, Israel. And I served there for like 6 months or something. And sometimes you go just three people for like a week or so to like this very tiny kind of base. And it's basically just like a kitchen, a place to sleep, and then one watchtower. And you sit in this watchtower and there is a valley underneath you with like Jordanian women doing laundry. And then in front of you, literally 100 meters in front of you on the other side of the ridge, you have a Syrian soldier, and there is a whole tank directed right at you. And I would just like sit there and just meditate on what I'm looking at and be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, is the land different over there? Are the trees different? Are the people different? Like, why is this situation the way it is? Right. And so it raised a lot of questions for me and always blew my mind. I think one of the things that kept me sane was psychedelics. I discovered LSD when I was in the army. I also had a lot of problems in the army because I was so resistant to a lot of things, and I would always ask questions and rebel and like be kind of like this bad soldier. They basically kind of sent the army police on me, and I went to a few interrogations. For really? The charge of, first for the charge of using drugs, which they didn't prove because I had this like fake urine.
Nice. You use Quick Fix.
Yeah.
Nice. Then Quick Fix.
Someone ratted at me from my base that I used this fake sample. And so they took me again. And this time I had like a trial.
Freaking narc.
In like an army court in Jaffa, for basically faking the thing. But even before that happened, when they were just like, you know, they took me for this, basically you are in a normal day in the base, a car that looks like a citizen car comes in, there are two officers sitting inside, you sit in front of them, it's completely silent, like super scary for like an 18 year old, and they drive you all the way to the military police base. They basically put my hands in handcuffs behind my back and started interrogating me, just like you interrogate like a criminal. And I would like, and I was like, I was scared shitless, but like a voice inside of me was like, they have nothing on you. They can go fuck themselves. They are not, they're not even real police. Like, I'm just denying everything. They let me sleep in this like solitary confinement for one night. And then they released me to go back to my base. But I had a lot of like, altercations with you know, with my commanders, with army around me. They always hated me because I was such a leftist liberal, and they just really, really despised me. I did endless hours in the kitchen cleaning massive pots that you can put your entire body into.
Kitchen patrol duty. That's where we said.
That's what they'll do, because look, you are not an outlier. There are plenty of IDF soldiers that I'm sure are just like you, but this is what happens to them. Yeah. They're pressured and punished for doing that. And I've heard that.
Yeah.
But you touched on something though. I have somewhat of a solution for Israel. I think if we lace the whole water supply with LSD, I think we could see some changes happen. Yeah. What do you think? I mean,
just, I think MDMA yeah. will be better.
Yeah. I mean,
ayahuasca, throw it in there.
I do think the CIA has a unique opportunity to just airdrop a bunch of LSD on Tel Aviv. Let's see if hardcore Zionism survives ego death.
Dude, but, I'm down. That's the one CIA experiment I'm down for. Right. The only one I'm down for.
By the way. But one thing I wanted to touch on was like compulsory service for everybody with a few exceptions, like the ultra orthodox. Do you feel like it kind of is self-reinforcing insofar as like it makes everybody complicit within the system of occupation and apartheid? Everybody serves in the military.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. Like, if you indoctrinate a person from day zero, that they are a foreign, that they are like a European or like a liberal society in between a bunch of barbaric Arabic countries that just want to annihilate you because they are Nazis. Mm-hmm. And then if that's not enough, they make you complicit in the occupation. Like, they actually make you complicit by putting you in the army. In the army itself, by the way, it's not just training and then combat. You have actual education, mandatory education hours that you need to do. You go to this class and then there's like a, you know, they teach you the history of Israel. And then you are there for 3 years. You've done bad things, especially if you're in combat, but even if not, you are in proximity, you know. Like, I, for example, consider myself very lucky that my 3 years of service were right in between of a bunch of wars and operations. I hadn't participated in any real combat or had to physically hurt anybody, and I consider myself very lucky, but it's not the case for most people, because it's so volatile. Every once in a while there is something, every year, every summer, every other month, whatever. So almost everybody that you know, that you see in Israel, has participated in some form of combat or beating or incarcerating or whatever, something. And if that's not enough, then you have other decades of mandatory reserve service. So you basically are a soldier your entire life. So everybody that you see in Israel almost entirely is either right before army, already doing this like youth, it's called Gadna. It's like in most kind of secular schools in Israel, you go to, you know, as a kid to do this kind of like army training thing to prepare you. Or they are in the army or doing reserves actively. So like, it's a militarized society. And what would you expect for something like that? Of course, everybody are complicit. Of course, they have a visceral, almost instinctual trigger response to any kind of criticism against Israel, because you're basically criticizing their own identity, their entire life.
That's the part that is the most foreign concept to me, because, you know, Americans, it's a tradition to shit talk our government, to shit talk the leadership. That's what we do as Americans. We shit talk our leadership. But for as
that exists in Israel too.
It does too, but like we, it's very normal in the United States to just criticize our government, talk shit about all the how evil we are, right? It's fairly, I mean, not amongst all groups, but.
Well, I mean, okay. Well, first of all, the First Amendment, the right to free speech, still exists for the moment. But I don't know, growing up in Texas, the whole like shit talking the government and stuff, it's not true for all Americans. Like, there is a lot of polarity at all. But I wanted to talk about like this sense of identity, especially within the veteran community. Like, I did 4 combat deployments in an illegal occupational war, and I try to get other vets to like speak out about it and be like, "Hey, what we did was stupid. We sacrificed our youth and buried our friends for the sake of imperialist lies." And it's really hard for a lot of people to accept that, because it's their identity, you know? They were a Navy SEAL or an Army Ranger or a freaking Marine, you know? And if they question the service, it throws their entire existence into question. And it's so formative to their identity that, yeah, I try to bring over as many as I can, but like, it's hard. And I suspect it's even harder if you were in the IDF and born into, yeah, you know, Israel.
I mean, I can tell you one anecdote. After finishing the mandatory service, I was called for reserves, and I went one time, and it was just like a kind of just a few days of drills of, you know, I was in artillery, so tanks in the desert. And as a citizen, after traveling the world for a little bit and having a life, you know, like having friends, having things that I'm into, like expressing my art in different ways, like loving my life, right? Going there for a few days and sitting there and listening to the conversations of other like Israeli citizens that I would not probably meet in my day to day in my circles outside of the army, but people that I did serve with, talk about how they are all absolutely looking forward to these reserve trainings and drills. Some of them were talking shit about their wives and how they are happy that they have like a vacation from the for the life. Others were like, it's so nice to not need to do my job. And I was like just reflecting to myself, and I was like, how fucking shit your life needs to be that this, like sitting in a fucking tank, sweating like a, yeah, like a maniac and eating tuna cans, is better than living your life. And I was like, that's not for me. And then next time that they called me, I went to the psychiatric ward in Ichilov hospital in Tel Aviv. And I, you know, it played like I'm going crazy. And eventually I managed to get out of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Also, I feel like if I was called back into service, I would just Irish exit the country and like never come back. I can't imagine putting on a uniform again. I'd go into like a complete
PTSD
melt. Yeah.
It helped.
I'm sure.
I wanted to talk about the indoctrination schools in the IDF. I've seen an Israeli journalist talk about this one particular school that trains officers, and it goes to very genocidal it goes to very genocidal details on the perspective of I believe they mix Judaism with this militantism with genocidal indoctrination. Have you heard of that? That one particular school that they sent officers to train in get training from a rabbi?
I was not an officer. Obviously, I was like the wrong material to take send to an officer training. But it doesn't sound surprising to me. Yeah.
So a $1 million question that I've been asking myself, you know, is what are Israelis thinking these days? Like, most of the videos we're seeing come out on social media have been very damning, but I've been holding off on solidifying any conclusion that Israelis as a whole are in approval of what has happened to Palestinians. I mean, I know how bad it is with the culture from firsthand experience over there, but I also met Israelis like you over there, like yourself. So the $1 billion question is, how common are Israelis like you? I mean, I've been trying to take an optimistic route of saying that there's a silent majority that is aligned with your viewpoints, but now I'm feeling like I'm just being naive.
No. Yeah.
There is.
I'm being naive.
It's definitely not a majority. And usually people who think like that are not very silent, because how can you be? Mm. I think the vast majority is what you could call like the two general kind of groups, which is one, the liberal, some of them even call themselves leftists, the liberal, like Tel Avivian, secular, like, you know, universalists kind of people into human rights. And then the other side, which is completely genocidal, maniacal, like settler, colonial, like fuck that, this is all ours, so and so and so on, both the secular part of them and also the of course the religious. And then you have other groups. You have like Arab Palestinian Israelis with Israeli passport, is at least 2 million of them, that have always been second class citizens and are now suffering even more, you can imagine. There is also another few millions, I think almost similar size of the like Orthodox, which are barely participating in taxes, if not at all, and not going to the army. And then you have other even smaller groups, but like the group that is actual leftists who are actually against what's going on is very, very small. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I try to point out. It's like, yeah, there are protests. There were protests in Tel Aviv before October 7th about the changes to the proposed changes to the Supreme Court and the judicial body of Israel. You spoke about earlier, like Netanyahu trying to install himself as a de facto dictator in some ways. But like the protests that we see, we can't deny that there are small groups like protesting for ceasefire. But the majority of the protests that we see, and because they're mounting, they're bring the hostages home protests.
Yeah. Which peace, is peace with the Arabs, the Palestinians, peace with the Arabs.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's like bring the hostages home protests. That means nothing because for a lot of complicated reasons, and get rid of Netanyahu protests. And now there are counter protests to the anti-Netanyahu protests. There are counter protests, pro-Bibi protests on the other side of the street. So it's a very, from an outside perspective, it's a pretty fraught and complicated internal situation within Israel. But I do think that it would be a mistake just to think that just because these protests are happening, most of the, according to polling data, reliable polling data from both left sources and right sources within Israel, most people support what's going on in Gaza. And most, go ahead.
No. You go to these, even the protests that are actually protesting the genocide and like, for example, showing photos of what's happening in Gaza, you always see like 15 people standing there and a much larger group kind of tears the pictures down, shouts at them, like curse at them, wish them death and rape and stuff. So it's like, it's existing. And I think there are definitely a lot more people who think this way and are silent. Many of them I heard from myself, like people who are, sorry. Like people who are afraid, literally afraid of their own safety, the safety of their children in schools, like people who are afraid for you know, their careers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But even with them, it's still a tiny, tiny, insignificant minority. And I think a trend that is very worrying, even in Israeli society, unlike the US, for example, when Gen Z and earlier generations are leading the kind of, like the younger the generation, the more progressive they are. In Israel, it's the opposite. Like, most of the leaders of like the actual left liberation movements are older and from earlier generations, like millennials are the youngest usually. And it's worrying. Yeah.
As we start to like wrap up, I just wanted to ask like, and shift to where do you see this going? Like where do you see this ending? If at all, or do you see this ideology continuing, you know, going down the black hole into pariah statehood?
Yeah. Do you see any hope? Do you see any hope at all? And where would that come from?
My hope and my sense of justice come not from a limited, cyclical human sense of justice and hope that is limited to a span of human lifetime and the expectation that everything will happen in our own lifetime. My sense of hope and justice come from just my own practice and aligning with greater patterns of nature and the fact that everything that goes up must come down. Everything that, you know, is being pushed to another direction will eventually balance to a different direction that, you know, this is what gives me hope. And I think beyond that, on the more kind of like geopolitical aspect of things, the societal, the political aspect of things, I'm not an expert on like really, you know, probably you both have even more knowledge than I do. I would quote someone that I do look up to and read many of his books, an ex-Israeli historian, Ilan Pepe, who speaks about how And I love listening to historians on these things because they have the perspective of, you know, thousands of years back and cycles of history that usually hard to see when we are just in the midst of what's going on. And he was talking about how he predicts that in the next 5 to 10 years, Israeli society will collapse from within. And so as the Israeli regime, as we know it, what exactly is going to replace it? Who knows? Will there be leadership within Palestinian society that will take initiative and take place? Will there be some kind of messy, wild transition period to a fully democratic one state or two federations with full human rights in both of them? Who knows? But one thing for sure is that, and what gives me a lot of hope, is that things just cannot sustainably continue the way they are. Not just because of it's impossible to maintain such brutal occupation and seasonal genocide solely on the support of one imperialist power, because that will shift. You know, generations will shift in the United States, and so is the support of Israel inevitably at some point. And once that fountain dries up, Israel doesn't exist. The only reason there is an IDF and there is an occupation and there is free healthcare in Israel is because of the United States taxpayer dollars. And I think that will dry up. On top of that, there is inner societal turmoil that is really unsustainable. On one hand, you have, first of all, the liberal Israelis who basically are secular, kind of like privileged into tech usually. They have usually two multiple passports. They would, when things get shitty, they bounce. And then all that you're left with is messianical, psychotic, fanatic, you know, kind of right wing. And then the 2 million Arabs, Israeli Arabs, which are obviously aligned with the Palestinian cause. And then you have the ultra-Orthodox who don't even go to the army and like completely, it's like a foreign body within Israeli society. And the tensions and the gaps between them are impossible to kind of bridge in a way that allows you to maintain this unanimous kind of national identity. And on top of that, of course, financial reasons. I think that ultimately and eventually, because you see what's happening in the world right now, in the ICJ, in the UN, the kind of growing movement to boycott Israel, eventually it will happen, just like it happened in many other places. I think eventually it will arrive to an end because of these reasons and these pressures. And I hope that's what will happen, and what will replace it will be better.
Just real quick, I've come to a philosophical fork in the road right now that I've been kind of waiting for until I talk to an actual Israeli again, since I lost a lot of my Israeli friends. And that is, I am going to be dropping my complete naivety and optimism about, you know, the silent majority. I've only kept that as a rule of thumb, that I never want to judge a whole society and assume that this is the majority speaking. But I'm at that point now where I'm going to drop that. I'm going to completely drop this optimism that there is a silent majority of people like yourself. I just wanted to kind of be reserved in that matter until I actually spoke with an Israeli who has a better perspective of it than I do. So that's officially done. Check mark, you know, going off.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad, and also it's depressing and kind of scary because, you know, it doesn't.
I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful and optimistic because not only because all the things that I mentioned, but because what is the alternative? I feel like the only thing that makes us keep going is the realization that something better is possible and historically has been possible. And that even this sober view of, you know, pessimistic view that you mentioned, Mark, of Israeli society is also, it's something that is important in order to continue the struggle. Like we need to help not just the Palestinian cause, but we need to help Israelis to stop oppressing. This situation is traumatizing for everybody for generations. And it must stop not just because of these people or that people, but for everybody, for humanity.
For everybody.
And exactly. we need to stay hopeful, and we need to stay kind of alive and engage if we want to sustainably continue this fight. And I think that's
and that's what you're here for. That's why your videos are so powerful. You provide that to your audience, and I just want to thank you for everything you're doing.
Yeah,
you will.
And thank you so much for coming on. Y'all, we will link Yuval's social media in the description. He makes content, short form videos about all these subjects, and we encourage you to follow him as well. All right, I think we're at the end of our time. Thank you so much for coming on, man. We really appreciate your perspective. And I do want to do a part two of this where I ask you about like the nitty gritty of like the IDF and how it's organized, why all of their officers are like so young. But that's we'd like to invite you on for that in the future.
Please, I'm down.
Another follow-up. Yeah,
that was enjoyable. Awesome. I would also love to hear more from you guys about, your perspectives as U.S. veterans. I'm sure I can learn a lot of interesting anecdotes from the heart of Empire.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
We got stories.
Yeah. All right, man. Thanks so much for coming on. And that's a wrap, y'all. See you next time.